Friday night, and we rolled up on Schmidt's home in Pasadena. It was a big and imposing building, the last house on the left of a dead-end street. The area was quiet, and the house was dark and set back on a wide plot that was surrounded by dense foliage. It felt kind of spooky and lonely. We watched the area for a good hour. I noted the houses across and next to Schmidt's looked dark and unoccupied. It might as well have been Schmidt's Island. As soon as we got to the front gate, the sound of dogs barking split the night. They sounded savage and hungry. Then a woman's voice cut across them, and they quieted down as we approached the front door. The door was opened, and an elderly-looking woman with overdone makeup and a crooked back looked out. She was surrounded by a pair of slavering German shepherds and two Dobermans who looked sleek and muscular. "You are cats?" she asked. And for a moment I had the absurd notion that the shepherds were smiling, just waiting for us to say yes and see what happens. Michael spoke up and said he was Katzenbach. The woman smiled a yellow-toothed smile, shooed the dogs inside, and beckoned us to come in. We were shown into a big dining room that was completely shuttered to the outside. It was dimly lit, and we were seated around a big wooden table. We waited about 10 minutes and admired the paintings and curios on display around the room. Most of the art were landscapes that looked like they were European in origin. Many of the curios appeared to be statues of heroes from history or gods and goddesses. They looked old and valuable. Schmidt had asked for a $500 fee to meet us, and when he arrived, he counted it and then handed it back to Michael. He said that it was a potential down payment on a job he would like us to consider doing. Schmidt was a small and slightly rotund man with oval-shaped spectacles and a sallow complexion. He was unremarkable and average-looking, yet he definitely had a kind of presence to him. Schmidt said he'd referred Winslow's letter and inquiry to a man named Gruber, who he said was an associate and more of an expert on certain areas of esoteric knowledge than he was. Apparently Winslow thought he was possessed by a demonic spirit that lived in the elephant statue. After conducting some initial research and seeing it for himself, Schmidt said that the statue was a representation of a potent god whose name was Shona Fawn. This god had the power to transfer to other bodies, live other lives, before returning to a sleeping place in an enchanted vessel like the statue. Schmidt had consulted Gruber, who was very excited about the discovery. This was back in June. Gruber promised some sort of follow-up, but had not been back in touch since. Gruber worked at White Sands, but had been absent since the middle of July. Schmidt said he and Gruber were not friends, but Schmidt respected his knowledge, and he wanted him found. White Sands was a missile range, rocket research, top secret. Schmidt said he and Gruber were colleagues back in Germany. They came to the U.S. in 1945 as part of Operation Paperclip. Rocket science was a cover. Schmidt, when asked, didn't wish to divulge what Gruber's actual activities were. Roger mentioned the pinstriped suited man and showed Schmidt some dust he had found on the statue. He identified it as being something called the Dust of Suleiman. It has the power, apparently, to reveal otherworldly things, such as a possessing entity. Expelling such an entity is difficult. Schmidt thought that it was possible that Fawn had moved to another body, and the process had been too much for Winslow's mind to handle. Gruber had told Schmidt that there was another god associated with Fawn, another great old one, so-called, by the name of Ran Tagoth. Schmidt opened an old tome, showed us a picture of a strange insectile monster that was reminiscent of a praying mantis. We recalled Winslow's notes and thought this was what the small golden idol that had been recovered represented. Ran Tagoth was a god of elites. His goal was the harvest, the ultimate prize. Michael asked for more information about Gruber, but other than giving us an address out in the desert near 29 Palms, Schmidt didn't have much more to say. It turned out that he was a former Berlin homicide detective who had been drafted into a special police unit within the Gestapo, whose job was to keep an eye on people like Gruber, who he said was a sorcerer. The Nazis apparently tolerated such people, as long as they behaved themselves and served the will of the Führer. Describing himself as a gamekeeper, he said that Gruber was both cunning and dangerous, and that were we to find him, we should let Schmidt know rather than try and contact him directly. Schmidt suspected we wouldn't find him alive, that he had come to some harm, but the death didn't mean that we couldn't still extract useful information from him. I was honest with Michael and Roger on the way home. I thought Schmidt was a lunatic, but the others didn't look so convinced. The following day, John Baldwin was uncontactable until he showed up at Katzenbach's house around noon, and he had quite the story to tell. He had picked up June, and she had directed him to a large estate buried in woodland in the hills above Malibu. John had a fast car, and thinking June was keeping information to herself, he tried some dangerous driving tricks to try and unsettle her, but to no avail. She was as cool as a cucumber. Eventually they arrived at a set of wrought iron gates, manned by large men in black tie, wearing silver masks. Invitations checked, John drove up a gravel track to arrive in the drive of a gothic-looking mansion. Plenty of people in black tie and evening dresses were getting out of their cars. Many film industry people, various local politicians, and sports stars. John noted that it was a whites-only event, including all the staff. June was radiant, laid into the bubbles heavily. John decided not to drink, but June pushed him, and he finally took a few sips from a glass of champagne. He spotted there was a second, smaller mansion set in sculpted woodland further up the hill, but the area was dark and apparently off-limits. John crossed paths with A-list movie stars, all-renowned Hellraisers. John Wayne, Errol Flynn, Spencer Tracy, Robert Mitchum, Ida Lupino, Jane Mansfield, Tallulah Banks, and Maureen O'Hara. These were all people with a reputation for booze, drugs, and sex. John nearly got into a fight with Mitchum over June's honor, but Armand Wolf showed up, and his mere presence took Mitchum's attitude down multiple notches. Mitchum apologized and skulked off. Armand told June that his wife, Anastasia, wanted to see her, and off she went. Armand took John on a walk around an ornamental lake. John was shocked to see his reflection in the lights in the water, showed his face completely healed and his handsome looks restored. Armand implied that what he had seen could be made to happen for real if John wanted it that way. He then took him to meet his wife, Anastasia Wolf, who was one of the most beautiful women he'd ever met. She implied that June was in love with him, but that her husband, Dick Powell, was in the way. Maybe John could do something about that. Over the next couple of hours, John and June wandered around the gardens, and they got on. June was alluring. Actually, she was allure abundant, almost irresistible. John couldn't avoid drinking. She had an easy time convincing him to do so. It made him feel and be better. He became the center of attention and got cards from a director and a producer. Laura Swan and Nathan Archer were also seen in the gardens. Nathan acted like the arrogant puke he was, but once Anastasia appeared, he quietened down, and Lara told him to get lost. John decided to try and speak to Nathan as June went for a powder. Archer and Baldwin made small talk. Nathan then graduated to locker room talk and said things about June that John didn't like. As he was thinking of doing something rash, like rearranging Archer's face, Nathan made it plain that there were two kinds of people, those that mattered and those that didn't. He made it clear that John was in the second category. Then he walked off and met up with Lara. Anastasia then invited John and June to join them at the house on the hill later that night. Around midnight, the crowds thinned out, and June led John to the mansion on the hill. They were met by masked servants who knew who they were. They were given masks, the sort of ones you might find in New Orleans for Mardi Gras or some Venetian-themed ball. They were separated and took different paths to meet in the middle. There were many more masked people, some which John could tell who they were from their attire. A topless woman wearing an exotic feathered mask fell into step with John. She told him that he was in great danger and should get out as soon as possible. She said to beware of dangerous women and to get out of there. But Armin Wolf showed up, escorted her away. June, now naked except for her undies, took her place. She said, "Everything is going to be fine. What we sow, we reap." As they walked together, they came across many semi to fully naked women lined up against the walls, with masked men on their arms. But June led John to a quiet part of the house, into a dark ballroom. A chaise longue was illuminated in a spotlight. She laid down and asked John to join her. John got cold feet, and he was the one with clothes on, so, you know, go figure. But he was creeped out. But he's still drawn to her, and it was a powerful attraction. But it's creepy. She really wanted to close the deal. She kissed him passionately, but he got more and more freaked out. He wanted to go. She said to him that their lives depended on that moment. John stood up and tried to pull her to her feet, but she slapped him hard and said that these people play for keeps. He implored her again to leave, but she wouldn't, so John knocked her out cold. Well, let's face it, he was always better with his hands than with his mouth. Then the lights went on, and they were surrounded by about 100 masked people all around, hidden in the shadows. A man in a red cloak with a golden mask slammed a gold-headed staff onto the ground and told John that he could leave unmolested, but without June. He said, "She's ours." Bronze masked men arrived to see Mr. Baldwin out of the house, but on the way, they knocked him out. He had woken in his car at one of the Venice Beach car parks that morning, and after heading home briefly to shower and change, he went straight to Michael's home. It was a frankly bizarre story, but to my mind, nothing that unusual for the jaded Hollywood set. At Michael's home, his houseman Paco prepared his lunch, and we discussed what had happened. Then, Danny Gillett showed up with some news on the location of Susan Wilden. It looked like she'd headed for Las Vegas.